Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 154 for comics originally released on July 21st, 2010. We are back from San Diego Comic-Con, or Comic-Con International : San Diego, as they now like to call it. I had a good time. How about you, Bob?
Very good. Very different year for me, but I liked it.
It was crowded this year.
You know, it was crowded, except the last couple of years I've noticed that Saturday has been the least crowded day down on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to a guy I used to get my comics from before he moved to, Memphis. He has a booth. He sells statues and stuff. He goes around and does cons. I was talking to him on Sunday, and I asked him basically how he was doing with his sales, and he was doing great on Sunday because people are out spending money on Sunday because it's Kids Day and stuff. But all the big panels are over by Sunday.
Yeah,
and he said this was like about 1 p.m. on Sunday, and he's doing great. But he said Saturday, terrible. It's like everyone was up in panels and stuff, and then the first couple of days, everyone's running around snatching up free stuff down by the, publishers and all the media booths and stuff. And by the last day, all the free stuff is gone. People are actually spending some money.
I think that really goes towards how the demographic of Comic-Con has shifted. I mean, obviously, we're hardcore comic book fans, but I was walking along the Harbor Drive side of the hall, so kind of the front side, if you will, up near the Star Wars area of the thing, which is kind of between the old school comic book section and the new school video game section. And there was this huge line, and I'm looking across it to see who's at the table behind it. And it was the actress from Stargate Universe who plays the Doctor. She played Black Canary on Smallville. And what I find very telling about that was the line was not for her. It was for the next booth over and cutting across in front of her to go pick up free bags from some book publisher. So the prevalence of people there for freebies and things like that, even over getting autographs from celebrities or TV stars or, whatever, I found a little shocking and a little disheartening.
And adjunct to that is the number of people that are there just to snatch up free stuff or get autographs that they almost immediately turn around and flip on eBay.
I have not even checked eBay this year for Comic-Con 2010.
Oh, there's all kinds of stuff.
And that's why I haven't checked. It's too disappointing.
I was talking to someone who had gotten a Matt Groening autograph on a San Diego exclusive Simpsons comic.
Uh-huh.
And he had it on eBay Saturday before the con was, while the con was still going on, and it was up to like $50 or $60 or something.
The first year Michael Shanks was there, he played Daniel Jackson on Stargate SG-1. He did an autograph signing, and it was, I think my sister was telling me, like less than 4 hours between the time the autograph signing started and she found it up on eBay. So, I mean, there are times where the speed of things getting flipped on eBay is just staggering. But I found the floor crowded every day from preview night on, and more so than in past years, where it's been crowded but you could still kind of move around. I had problems sometimes getting where I was going and found it really annoying. But it was a good convention, and it's one of those things where its biggest failure right now is that it's so successful and that everybody goes to it for the most part. So certainly worth checking out. At some point, I'll go through both my photos, see what I saw, and I'll go through all the postings on, Newsarama, Comic Book Resources, and elsewhere, just to see what I missed at the convention. So, but it was definitely fun and something I recommend any serious comic book fan check out at some point.
Well, you know, even with the prevalence of all the Hollywood and video games and all that kind of stuff, if you actually love comics, there's tons of comic book stuff there, and you can ignore all that Hollywood stuff and just do comics if you want. And there's tons of comics. I mean, this year I skipped all the Marvel and DC stuff. I mean, I walked through the DC booth a couple of times. It was totally crowded, huge lines to get, you know, like they had that table with the free dollar comics and other kind of things on it. You know, the After the Watchmen or First Look kind of things. Huge lines. And interestingly, I don't remember what day it was. It was maybe Friday or Saturday. There was no, they had piles of Vertigo comics, you know, the same ones, Vertigo and Wildstorm free books. No one was standing in line for those. I just walked up and I got Constantine, number one, Scalped, Jack of Fables, Fables. And they were just, nobody was there. Nobody wanted to pick those up.
Interesting. I went into the DC booth a couple of times. I always go to check out what DC Direct has. I liked how they had a display of big Green Lantern stuff, big lanterns for each of the colored cores. And then in the display cabinet, they had smaller ones and stuff. So I also went to, you know, talk to a friend of the show, Dave Beatty, after his signing, and also Mike Norton after his. Both of those guys seem to be doing pretty well these days, and always fun to see them signing at the DC booth, which, you know, I was talking to Dave after his signing. I mean, that's like the pinnacle. I mean, that's the top of the stack as far as, you know, where to do a comic book signing. In San Diego, in the DC booth, and for Dave on a high-profile DC book. And, of course, Norton signed there a number of times on a number of different books, you know, so cool to see them being successful and getting the recognition and stuff for that. So, we ready to dive into the comics for this week?
Sure. Our first book is Time Master's Vanishing Point, or also known as Booster Gold by Dan Jurgens and Norm Rapmund. This pretty much follows along with the Booster Gold series before the main Booster Gold series got JLI'd.
Yeah, I think it also features very heavily Rip Hunter. I mean, obviously.
Well, Rip was pretty heavily in the regular Booster book, too.
He was, but he was more supporting cast there to Booster, whereas I felt here Booster was a little more supporting cast to Rip. And it's a fairly even balance, and both are great characters. I liked how this started with, you know, Booster and Rip and kind of some of their history and stuff. This whole bit of the search for Bruce Wayne is, I don't, it's not played out, it's playing out, but the release schedule for this versus the Return of Bruce Wayne miniseries seems a little off. Maybe this should have started a little earlier. They're covering some interesting ground, and I like this because I like this take on Rip and Booster. You know, whereas, like you said, the Justice League International take on Booster's book, going more for the blah-ha-ha stuff, I mean, that's fine and good too, but I prefer the more heroic angle and more serious take. I don't know about you, but I was a bit surprised to see Supernova show up, because it's been a while since we've seen either the character or the costume, and frankly, I don't recall who was in the costume last we saw it.
Yeah, I thought it was Daniel Carter, right? But
at one point, I thought it was Booster's dad or something like that. I'd have to go reread some of it, because it's been a year or so at least since those characters showed up. But even Daniel had kind of faded to the background of Booster's book for a while. So bringing him back was cool and was well done. But it would have worked better if he'd been more in play in the Booster book recently. I thought it was funny near the middle of the book we had to get some exposition kind of explaining or recapping, I should say, the key events at the end of Final Crisis with Batman that kind of, you know, trigger this entire adventure. It was well done. The archivist, though, at the spot at the end of time, I forget what they're calling that, just seemed almost out of nowhere. It's like, who is the archivist, or what is the archivist? And it seemed like they were making such a point of pointing him out and setting him up that that's gonna have to play out in some manner at the end. And I've got a bit of a It's Skeets feeling to it. We'll see what happens with that.
I got, well, for me, I mean, I like the series. I mean, I like the story, but this whole searching for Batman business, you said it's playing out. For me, it's played out. I mean,
well,
I,
and that was kind of my point, is we're just starting into it, but it already feels like we've been in it too long.
I didn't feel Batman, you know, it's like, no one, I never thought he was dead, you know, and then like from day one, he wasn't dead. And, you know, so that was, you know, kind of off the table. And then you kind of knew he was back in time because they showed that little teaser image of someone painting the bat on the wall and everything. But it's just been dragging on for so long. It's just like, bring him back. You know?
Yeah.
You'll look at the next, you know, see the previews episode next month. I mean, next week, rather, that we put out. And, you know, there's a slew of Batman Returns one-shots in the new previews catalog that came out. And, you know, they're going to beat this one into the ground.
Yeah. Well, what I found interesting with this is I liked the story. I like the execution of the story, because I agree with you that this whole bit of Bruce being gone, we know he's coming back, just... okay, tell some stories in the meanwhile, but let's just move on and get him back in a quick time frame, not play it out over 6 months or whatever. So I'm a little, you know, I guess impatient's the best way to phrase that. But I'm enjoying the way, I'm enjoying the execution of the story. It's good art, good story. There were a couple of things that I'm going to nitpick about. If you go to the page, a little after, a couple of pages after the staple, where we first see Rip's lab, the exterior. Looks very different than we've seen before. Go to that previous page where we've got Hal Jordan, you know, Green Lantern. The coloring there is a very stark, okay, it's solid black for those parts of the costume. Felt a little off. So, I mean, in terms of the nitpicking on the art direction, the coloring and stuff, I mean, it didn't take away anything from the story, but it's something that always just kind of niggled the back of my mind saying, okay, it's a little off, it's a little off. You know, it's like your steering wheel being slightly out of alignment. You can still drive fine, but what I liked, though, was when we get to Rip's lab, we've got Degaton and Despero, which I thought was a really unusual pairing, but a really cool one, because Degaton is a classic JSA villain, and Despero is a classic JLA villain. So seeing those two kind of paired up, you know, and it's almost a nonsensical pairing, because Degaton has always had a little bit of that, you know, I guess Hitlerish aspect to him. Not, I guess he's never been that much for the racial purity or whatever, but him teaming up with an alien just seems kind of funny.
It's also, when did they flip Despero back to the kind of classic Despero look? Because for a while they had him as this big hulking guy.
You know, that's a good point. This may be the first time we've seen him in this, but in the back of my mind, I'm also thinking that we saw Degaton last in the Lightning Saga back in JLA JSA a couple of years back, and he was with a few other people at that point, and I don't remember if Despero was one of them or not. But you're right, one of the last times we saw Despero, he had really much more of a Savage Dragon look, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah,
the fin going in that direction versus the way it's going here, and him being, like you said, just huge. So there are a couple of things here and there like that that, you know, seem a little, not so much out of place, but given how many titles DC's publishing, I guess it's hard for them to kind of keep a few things in sync. But
is this bi-monthly?
I mean,
not bi-monthly. Is it bi-weekly? Because
I'm thinking
this
monthly.
Is playing out the search for Batman... Batman the Return is supposed to come out in like October or something.
It
right?
may be biweekly.
So I don't, you know, if this is a 6-issue series, I don't see how that's going to time-wise play out if the last issue of this comes out 3 months after Batman Returns in the Batman Returns comic.
It says it's published monthly.
Yeah, I saw that. That's why
I questioned
curious
that too.
About that.
The other thing that kind of I thought was a little funny is Rip's trying to communicate through time with his lab. So let's go to high ground. Why does high ground matter if you're communicating across time? That just seemed a little odd. One thing I will say, though, is I liked how at the end of this, they're bringing in at least one and presumably a couple of more in future issues older unused characters in the DC lineup and how they're kind of integrating this stuff back into the mythos and taking it essentially, you know, off the shelf, dust it off and put it back into play in some shape. You know, I always enjoy when they do those sorts of things. And overall, you know, I don't know that we need the Search for Batman to spill out across six issues of this, plus the return of Bruce Wayne, plus all the one-shots they're going to do, and all of that. But that having been said, I like Rip Hunter, I like Booster Gold, I like Dan Jurgens and Norm Ratman doing this book. I'm enjoying this, and this first issue for me was a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I gave it a 4 out of 5 also. I thought it was really well done.
So I'm looking forward to future issues, and if that last page is any indication, I think we're going to see some pretty cool cameos and appearances of characters that just haven't been used much over recent years.
Okay, next we've got Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 638, One Moment in Time, Part 1, where Joe Quesada comes back and tries to explain the one moment in time that Mephisto changed to kind of put the kibosh on Peter and Mary Jane's wedding. And this is intercut with pages from Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 21, which is the wedding.
Now, that issue came out in 1987. So the story that they're diving into and retelling and tweaking is, you know, over 20 years old. So there are going to be a couple of younger readers of this that are like, what the hell? And I don't know, I just, this issue, I don't know for you, but for me it started off really on the wrong foot with that opening reveal of Mary Jane's deal with Mephisto, which I thought was just a complete letdown. And I'm like, that? You've got to be kidding.
Well, yeah, be watching to see if Mephisto toys with Spider-Man ever again.
You know, you
Mephisto never did anything to Spider-Man before this. He came jumping out of the bushes completely, you know, out of the blue in that story in the first place. So don't see why he'd ever want to come back and do something to him again.
You know, you take that, you take what I consider to be okay but slightly lackluster art for the new pages and intermix it with, you know, 1987 material where you got the thought balloons, you've got a different coloring style, different art style. And, I mean, overall, the pages worked and whatnot. It was just an odd juxtaposition of the art styles in places. And, I don't know, it just, as I was reading this, it seemed like the exact sort of story that I've heard various creators complain about in the past of a story to explain a past story. And I'm not positive, but that seems like the kind of thing that Quesada has rebelled against a number of times. And maybe I'm just wrong about that. But it seemed so much like a literal strip mining of past stories. And it was okay. It was well done. But it just seemed counter to the whole point of One More Day and making that shift. And this story really took me out of the here and now of the current Spider-Man stuff by telling a twisted version of the wedding tale. And I thought it was a really bad follow-up to the Grim Hunt storyline.
The Grim Hunt storyline I really enjoyed, by the way.
I just read the last two parts of it before reading this. And it was really solid, really, I'm going to go with sophisticated, and it had some subtlety and some characterization there and stuff. And then we get to this, which is comparatively a almost freewheeling kind of a, I don't know, there were aspects of this story that just seemed very loose in structure and intent and unclear in places. I'm still not entirely sure what moment in time got changed. There were a few things that...
Oh, it was the letting this guy out of the police car.
That's what I figured. But it just seemed...
It was this pigeon. The pigeon's an agent of Mephisto.
It just seemed so heavy-handed and, you know, you got to be kidding me or whatever.
Because basically it's like because they let this guy go, I'm ruining this for people.
Yeah,
it's not a great story, so...
You're not ruining like it any more than Quesada.
I'm not ruining a whole lot for you. But, you know, basically in Spider-Man Annual number 21, he... you know, stop some crime and, you know, web some criminal up to a light post and all this kind of stuff. And then that criminal, you know, kind of between the panels, you know, he gets hauled away to jail and that's the end of it. So here, the one moment in time is Mephisto takes this guy who was webbed up by Spider-Man and fixes it so that he escapes from the police car while the police aren't paying attention, apparently. They, you know, New York's finest, right? So the guy gets out of the police car, kind of runs away handcuffed with spider webs hanging off him. And then, you know, various things happen where, as the story goes on, he now has a further interaction with Spider-Man that it looks like what's going to what happened here is, because this guy escaped and then Spider-Man had the subsequent interaction, it prevents Spider-Man from showing up at his own wedding. And this is what put the kibosh on the wedding, is Peter misses his own wedding because he was off superheroing around in a kind of goofy way with this criminal who escaped. So that was the one moment in time. And this is going on for how many more parts before it mercifully ends?
I was thinking it was a 4-part.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm hoping it's shorter than that.
But I don't know where they're going from here. So he missed the wedding, and you see MJ kind of walking off in, I'm assuming, tears. Her little wedding rose laying forlornly on the ground there, while Spider-Man's unconscious. On a rooftop or alleyway somewhere, and then we'll be dealing with three issues of the repercussions of, how dare you miss our wedding? I was fighting crime! I don't care! You know, okay.
I mean,
it was okay. I mean, it was not the worst story I've ever read.
Yeah, that's where I was. I didn't hate the story, but I was just disappointed by it. I'm like,
it wasn't as good as what we've been seeing in Spider-Man. And again, I agree with you. Going back and rehashing this, I'm not convinced that it needed to be done. And spending 4 issues on it and the big omit, you know, the big campaign around it and everything. It's like, big campaign and this is what we get? Okay.
It was oversold. If we had just done this issue and, oh, this is what it happens to be or whatever. One thing, but again, all the hype, oh, we're going to reveal all this stuff, and I'm like, again, the reveal at the beginning I thought was, you know, oh, don't mess with Spidey again. Wow, what a clever deal. And frankly, I would have liked to have seen, I mean, there's so much more they could have done with this. They could have played on the whole omit thing by having, you know, the Amazing Spider-Girl show up, because she essentially got the kibosh and continuity here. With them not getting married, therefore Mary Jane never got pregnant, yada yada. And I mean, there's a lot they could have done. And maybe they will in future, you know, parts of the storyline. But the whole bit with that guy escaping, you know, first because the pigeon or bird or whatever somehow got into the police car and almost but not quite hits the unlock button and then flies out and then magically the things unpop or, you know, unlock or whatever. It's like, you know, there was a 2-page sequence there that just didn't need to happen. I don't know. It was disappointing. It was effectively told. It, you know, held together on those marks. So for me, I'm going to give it either a high 2 or a low 3. And I'm leaning towards the low 3 because, you know, on a technical level, it was well done. It told a story. And there was quite a bit of story in here.
Yeah, I give it a 3. I mean, it was an okay story. Again, it was just the hype that surrounded this issue was not paid off on.
I'll give the story a 3. I'll give the marketing a 1.
Yeah, there you go. It was an okay story. I mean, it's like, I not something that I would recommend somebody like pick up and judge the current run of Spider-Man.
No, God, no, not at all.
Go read the Grim Hunt, though. I mean, that was pretty good.
Hell, you could pick almost any random issue they've done between One More Day and this.
And I've got my fingers crossed on this Origin of the Species that's coming up, written by Mark Waid. You know, I'm really excited about that because, you know, Waid's a great writer. So,
yeah,
I'm really looking forward to that.
It just seems
Masada,
like
this not so much.
This is killing some momentum.
I just think they shouldn't let editor-in-chiefs write books. Or chief creative offices. Although, I guess Jeff Johns could keep on doing it.
Yeah.
How do you like about every company is now jumping on the bandwagon with that? DC created a chief creative officer. Now Marvel's got it. You know, Quesada's been promoted to chief creative officer. Wade is now chief creative officer at Boom. It's like everyone's, oh, chief creative officer. Let's now make that.
Yeah, it does seem they started a bit of a trend, and there's a jumping on the bandwagon stuff there. But the irony is that's a reflection of the creative bankruptcy in comics at times of if it's working for one person or one company, let's all do it. And the Me Too aspect is a little disheartening, particularly for the irony of it being chief creative officer. You know, they couldn't come up with some other name at these other companies and have it be essentially this. I don't know. It just seems weird.
Okay, moving on, we have our indie book. We haven't done in a while, but a book we're both big fans of. That's Walking Dead 75. First issue for Skybound Entertainment.
Yeah, I was just noticing that. I had read 74 immediately before this because it just came out 2 weeks ago. You know, and Kirkman's apparently happy that, oh, we'll get 12 issues out. It's like, yeah, but can you get them out on a regular schedule? And that previous issue I'm checking right now was for Image Comics and didn't have the Skybound stuff. So this marks officially, I guess, the beginning of the Skybound imprint for Kirkman, which I find just interesting as a process junkie. And I've still got to read up on what the deal is with new creators going through Skybound versus the Image Central line, etc. I am glad I read 74 right before reading this because, one, it follows right up on the heels, but two, there were a couple of things, story points that I might have gotten a little lost on if I'd read it a couple of weeks back before Comic-Con and things like that. Specifically, a couple of the characters out looking for medical supplies. It's like, wait, where did we leave them? And it's a big enough cast that at times it's easy to lose track of where certain characters are and what's going on. And I think Kirkman could do a better job reestablishing some of that each issue. I don't think he does a horrible job, but that's just something that I found on a lot of things of his that I've read is an area he could improve on.
So, I mean, I like the issue. The back half after the staple, and I'm kind of guessing that the black and white page after the staple doesn't count as part of the story either.
I think this backup feature has the potential of really backfiring on him, and that some people are going to be confused as to about that black and white page after the letter page. Is it part of the backup or is it part of the main feature?
Yeah, so basically, give people a little context. So Walking Dead, I mean, we've talked about before. It's kind of a post-apocalyptic zombie tale. You have these survivors. They never really explain what started the zombie plague. The main character, Rick, he just, you know, he's a cop, and he was injured in the line of duty. He's in a coma. He wakes up in the hospital and finds that he's in the middle of the zombie apocalypse. There's zombies wandering around. There's nobody alive in the hospital. And, you know, he's off and he tries to find his family and all kinds of stuff happens. And this, the good thing about this story is it's more about the people who are surviving than it is just, you know, zombies, you know, ripping people up and eating them and all this kind of business. So back, apparently way back when, in issue 7, there was a letter where somebody, you know, says, you know, I hope this goes on for a long time and, you know, awesome job and all the kind of standard stuff. And Robert Kirkman responds to it saying, I will never stop writing this book. I plan on writing it right into the ground. When I run out of ideas, I'll just start adding aliens and stuff. I recommend jumping off at issue 75. Everything up to that point will be kick-ass, so don't worry. And then he adds, current day, says, wait a minute, what did I just say? Don't jump off at 75. It's just now finally starting to get good, you know. And I think it's, you know, that back then in issue 7, he never thought he was going to get to issue 75. Because, you know, let's be honest, you know, how many indie books make it past issue 20? You know, this is an anomaly. You know, he caught lightning in a bottle with this series. But, you know, then he says, well, you know, and here's the thing. I aim to please. I promise aliens in issue 75, and I plan to deliver. Did you think this issue was over? Think again. You know, and then he goes in, and there's this whole backup story that's, it's in color. It's back with the, is that Tony Moore doing the art? I think so. Who was the original artist on Walking Dead for the first little bit before Charlie Adler took over. Or maybe it's Ryan Ottley who's doing that back part, who's the Invincible artist. No, it's Ryan Ottley who does Invincible. Anyway, it's, you know, so it's color, it's like kind of sci-fi and aliens, and you see some of the characters from Walking Dead, and there's kind of a, you know, just crazy, and it's, you know, ends up with not to be continued. So, I mean, it's just, to me, I take it as being a little fun, totally out of continuity thing that he did, just as a humorous riff on what he had written way back when.
Oh, entirely. But with Kirkman, it's entirely conceivable he could have decided to flip the thing out and go in a totally different direction. It would have been a huge, huge mistake, but, you know, it's his book, and frankly, if he'd really wanted to go that way, he could.
Yep. And then they've got some full-page character portraits of people who are going to be in the Walking Dead TV series. It's going to be premiering on AMC at the end of October. I don't know about you. I liked the casting on everyone except Laurie. Laurie, just, there's something about her. Something about, she wasn't doing it for me.
No, I didn't really have any issues with the casting and stuff.
And that second zombie, I didn't think they cast that one very good.
I see. I question how much of the show I'll be able to stomach.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be on TV, so it's not going to be that bad.
We'll see. I guess the thing I've got with Walking Dead these days is, first off, in this issue, I thought Rick's action seemed a little kind of hardcore and a little overreaction-y. They'd kind of built up to it, so it was kind of, you know, yeah, almost telegraphed, they're going to go this way. And there were a lot of kind of plot lines introduced here. And this is, in some respects, other than the back matter, a typical issue of Walking Dead. And really, it's the middle issue or middle chapter of an ongoing storyline. It's one of the few books that's got that never-ending saga, both in good ways and bad ways. And I'm still really enjoying the series, and I think he's doing a good job, but I don't think it's as strong creatively now as it has been at certain times in the past. You know, back when they were in the prison and, you know, they go out and they see all these tanks and stuff, and it's like, oh, crap, that's not good. You know, I haven't really felt that kind of a moment in the book in a while. And it's harder and harder for Kirkman to keep topping himself in that respect or pulling those kinds of moments. And whereas this book used to have an anything can happen and routinely did, I haven't been feeling that for a little while these days. And I've been having a similar sort of a feeling on some of his other stuff like Invincible. Certainly, I don't think Astounding Wolfman is his best work by a long shot. He's still a very strong writer and very consistent in quality, but it's hard to, for me, it's hard to say this is the pinnacle of the book, you know, in terms of creative quality. It's still head and shoulders, I think, above a lot of stuff, but, you know, I'm curious to see where things shake out after the events right before the letter page, because I'm, again, assuming that page after doesn't count. And I'm very curious to see how well they're able to capture the tone and style and feel of the book in the TV show. And I hope that's successful, because if it is, that gives Kirkman a steady revenue stream to really go play around and do pretty much whatever the hell he'd like in comics. And, you know, maybe he can capture lightning in the bottle again. Because I would say, aside from Walking Dead and Invincible, he really hasn't had any other huge successes. He's had a couple of books go for about two years plus, but nothing else along the lines of either of those two books.
Well, I think it's just what people gravitate towards. Because, I mean, like the Brit stuff he did, I thought that was every bit as good as anything else he's ever done. People just didn't gravitate to it. And when Britt actually finally got a series, other than the one shots, it was done by somebody else. It wasn't Kirkman, because he can only do so much. And there's a certain point where just doing some of this overextension, I guess, there seems to be only so much he can do. And as he gets distracted with, you know, working on the TV show and doing this and that, it's just how much can he do? I mean, the pilot season's a good example. You know, it's like doing all six of those books himself and the last, well, I guess Stellar just got released. The last one should be coming out pretty soon, but I mean, that kind of dragged out over a long time. It's just, you know, he's got a lot of stuff to do. He's only one guy, you know.
Well, he needs to pick what he's going to do a little better and focus a little bit better, because I agree, he's totally overextended. In addition to doing all the pilot season stuff, Walking Dead, Invincible, Astounding Wolfman, which he's ended, he's got Guardians of the Globe, or Global Guardians, or whatever the hell, Guarding the Globe, is what they renamed that to, plus running the Image Central line, plus this new Skybound imprint, you know, plus the TV series. It's like, yeah, of course he's overextended, but he's kind of put himself in that position too. And I think part of when this book was better was when he was able to focus a bit more on it and focus on the here and now aspect of it versus, okay, let's get a TV show spun up.
Yeah. Well, back to talking about this issue specifically, I liked at the beginning how, you know, the priest, you know, Gabriel is like ratting out Rick and these guys. And that was kind of like the big thing at the end of last issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, what a this priest is. He's going to like rat these guys out. But then there's this guy, Abraham. You know, he's pretty much like, ah, you know, piss off. I'm, you know, it's like everyone's done things that they shouldn't have done. So that was a good, you know, kind of resolution to that. But then Rick, you know, Rick, I think, has been a little mentally unstable for a while, you know,
yeah,
since Lori and the baby were killed. I think that really kind of set him off down on a dark path mentally. And I think this is just playing out in this issue. I mean, he can't control himself, and he's gone a little nuts, and that's what we're seeing here. You know, it made a certain amount of sense. I liked the character moment. I'm really curious as to, it's not like, you know, the tanks and everything, but I'm, now that he's pulled a gun on people and, you know, done this kind of stuff, I'm really curious as to where this is going. You know, he's kind of ruined being in Washington, D.C., the safe community. And to some extent, that needed to happen for the viability of this series, because you can't have this series with everybody cozily living in this, you know, zombie-free zone with the big steel wall around it, and they're all safe and happy and all this kind of stuff, because that's not that exciting. You know?
Exactly. It lacks the drama, suspense. And
So something has to happen to get, not everyone, because I think some people are going to stay. So they're going to be shaking up the cast again. Rick and probably Carl and some others are going to get their kicked out now. And they had to set, you know, Kirkman had to set that up. And the way that he's doing it here, I think, makes sense, you know, for how the character development's going on. So, I mean, all in all, I thought it was another solid issue. You know, I give it a solid, you know, high 4. It remains consistent. And again, you know, that back part was fun, but, you know, don't take it too seriously, people.
You know, I think this would have been more interesting, because I agree, they can't stay in here forever and just have a nice, serene, you know, suburban life with the zombies around the outer fence. But at this point, it's looking like just Rick and Carl are going to get the boot. So are we going to follow them? Are we going to stay in the town? Are we going to split the focus? It might have been more interesting if they had done kind of almost a civil war inside what was looking to be a peaceful community suburb and zombie land or what have you, and really have more of a dividing line kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think some people might go with Rick if he gets out. I don't think everyone's going to go with Rick, so I'll be curious on how Kirkman plays out the rationale. And I mean, it's not like they're going to kick him out in the first two pages of next issue. There's
right,
going to be just more stuff happening here.
Oh, totally, totally. But at this point, nobody has to go with Rick other than, you know, his son Carl.
Right, but whereas, I'm saying, it's how is the aftermath of this moment going to lead up? And I think that's where the dividing lines are going to be drawn, that some people will be given a reason to go with Rick and others will stay.
Fair enough.
I think that'll play
that
out over the next few issues.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. I'm just saying that it could have been set up a little bit better to where it got to the point where it was a confrontation between Rick and Abraham, and you already had 4 or 5 very clear factions, and the whole survival of the town was in question, Whereas now the only thing in question is who goes with Rick. So he could have amped it up and made it a lot more a, well, that was fun while it lasted, but oh crap, now what happens? And maybe it'll go that way, who knows? But based on this issue, I thought his actions were, yeah, and he has been a little nuts. I didn't think they were out of character. I thought they were a little overreaction-y. But again, that fits the way the character's been building up. So for me, I'm going to give it a high 3. It's still a good book, but it's getting to where it's not the I can't believe what I just read, wow, that's amazing kind of a book that it used to be for me. And I attribute a lot of that to just Kirkman being, you know, overextended.
Yep. So solid 4 for me.
Okay. Other than that, the only thing I have read from this shipment is Legion of Superheroes. I am behind both the rest of this shipment, the one last week that came out while I was at Comic-Con, most of the one after prior to that, which came out the week before Comic-Con, and I've got other straggling issues. So I've got close to 200 comics in the to-read stack that I need to find the time to plow through at some point.
I read a bunch of number one issues and things that I got kind of pre-release versions. I got Morning Glories number one from Image that I really liked. They handed out a advanced copy of that at San Diego at the Image panel. And that was one that I was on a tryout on till I saw the first issue. Loved the first issue, so I'll be adding that to my pull list. Murderland, also from Image. Liked the first issue there. I'll be adding that one in. I picked up CBGB. Music-oriented comic from Boom by Kieran Gillen, wrote the first story in that. I picked that one up because I was talking to Kieran about Phonogram, and he said, oh yeah, there's likely not going to be any more Phonogram. Just wasn't selling well enough for them to do anymore. But if you like my music comics, go check out CBGB over at the Image booth, I mean at the Boom booth. So I did that, and I liked it. I liked his story a lot. I liked the second story in there. It was okay, but it was a good series. If you like kind of music oriented comics, and you know, again, kind of calls back to punk rock and other stuff like that, which I was big into back in the early 80s. So it was a very good issue. And CBGB, it's a club in New York. It actually stands for Country, Bluegrass, and Blues. A lot of people don't know what that stands for. That was when the guy opened the club. He was thinking of having country, bluegrass, and blues, and it actually not being the focus. He ended up with a lot of punk rock and hard rock and cutting-edge rock acts coming to that club, and that's what the club is more known for at this point. There's a number of other books that Time Bomb number one came out from Radical, which I loved. But you know, Paul Galassi's art is just a visual feast for me. I love Paul Galassi, and I'll buy anything the guy draws. Paul Miatti's story, we've talked about it a number of times. You know, very well done. Hotwire, first issue came out. Yeah, it was there in San Diego, the new Hotwire series. Again, you know, you can't go wrong with Steve Pugh and his art. A lot of great stuff. Radical had like a bunch of number one issues that they pumped out for San Diego.
Makes sense. And they were giving a lot of stuff away. My sister was saying she couldn't walk by that booth without getting something handed to her.
Yeah, they were doing a very big promotional job there. So I read the Astro City Silver Agent special. You know, been a lot of comics that came out. So, in any event, a couple of big weeks, the last few weeks, I also have several huge piles of comics that still need to be read, but, overall, some good stuff coming out. I think there's more stuff coming out than I can reasonably read in a month. And my pile keeps growing, which is why I've been trying to cut back. And I'm really getting to the point where if something's not consistently, I mean, if it's not consistently 4 and above, then it's in the questionable category, you know. And if it's mostly a 3 or sometimes a 2, it's potentially something that I'm going to stop getting just because I can't read everything that's out there. And there's so many books out there, you don't really have to. I mean, you could easily, depending on your tastes, I mean, almost anybody should be able to go out there and find 20 to 25 books that are consistently fours and fives for them. And that's going to be a completely different list for each person that pulls it together. But yeah, there's so many things out there.
Yeah, well, the problem I'm having is just not having the time to be reading, regardless of, you know, what rating I'd give the books.
Right.
You know, again, I always get behind around the time of San Diego just because I drive out from Texas. That's 2 days in each direction. So there's about a week and a half, 2 week period there between, you know, getting ready for the trip and taking care of some stuff when I get back where I get virtually no reading done. If I've read more than a dozen comics over the last 2 weeks, I would be surprised. Maybe just over a dozen, because I read the three for this week, another four plus the three from last week. So that's 10 right there. Yeah, so that's less than a dozen in the last 2 weeks. So, I mean, that's part of why I'm falling behind. So,
well, I've read a decent amount, but then I'm going through a major reshuffling of my comic room also, which is...
Yes, I witnessed that firsthand. Major.
Well, I did a whole nother big thing yesterday that kind of... I brought that big... Well, I brought another big wall unit in.
Cool.
You know, down in the living room, that oak unit that was against the wall next to the fireplace?
Yeah.
That's now in my room. It's sitting next to the couch where that little end table used to be.
Oh, wow.
And I moved the comic book rack over next to the bookcase where I've got all the Carl Barks and EC books.
Well, once you get this done, you'll have to take some photos and we'll get that up on the website.
It's just, it's in a huge state of flux right now. So I don't know how long it's going to take me to finish up.
Well, when you get it done, we'll put the photos up. So cool. Anything else? Or does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for me.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Action Comics number 891 from DC, Peter Parker number 5 from Marvel, and Artifacts number 1 from Top Cow Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.